You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. My guest this week is author Tahira Rahmatulla. Her new book is, in fact, co-author of the new book, Waiting to Inhale, Cannabis Legalization and the Fight for Racial Justice. And as a side note, just before broadcast, Tahira and I had a chance to talk a little bit, and I was reminiscing about the early days here, at least in Massachusetts, central Massachusetts, that is, growing up as a teenager, and the slightest amount in those days we called a small amount of marijuana or cannabis, a nickel bag, carried in many cases, depending on the community in which you lived in, either a misdemeanor or you know, considered a controlled substance. As you know, much of that has changed globally today. So for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Tahira, getting her views and the reasons and the motivations for writing her new book, Waiting to Inhale. Tahira, nice to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now that I gave the history of Voner and his you know, experience as a teenager, but you know, it was just so... everybody looked at one another like, what's the big deal, man? I mean, you know, the worst that can happen is I'm going to fall asleep or I'm going to get hungry. And that was usually the reaction. You know, you get a bunch of kids together in a local park on a Friday or Saturday night. It was inevitable that somebody had, you know, marijuana and, mm-hmm. and did it with it. But there was a stigma. Parents in those days, and I'm going back, as I said, to late 60s, early 70s, you know, really found out that, you know, your son or your daughter was using cannabis or marijuana, certainly came down hard on you. Some communities were, you know, harder than others in terms of penalties or punishments, if you will. As you know, things have basically done a 360 globally, communities around the globe, and even here in this country, certainly strides have been made to change all of that. But going back to the book itself, Waiting to Inhale, did any of that play into the motivation for writing the book in the first place?
Absolutely. I think for myself and for Akwasi, you know, we think about our own childhoods in different locations. I grew up in Ohio. Cannabis was everywhere. And we thought about just the stigma that was around it then, the stigma that is still there today in different populations, but also the massive changes that have happened. And we're both involved in the cannabis industry in different capacities. And that's why we came together to kind of share these different lenses. You know, there's the business side, which I'm much more involved with. There's the policy and education and research side, which Akwasi is more involved with. And just seeing that massive change that's happened, yet there are still so many people suffering from cannabis prohibition, while other people are now profiting from it greatly. And you know, there's still this big divide over who is allowed to participate and who cannot. And people who maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago were charged, and actually not even that long ago, were charged with cannabis crimes that are now legal, yet they're still sitting in prison. And so just pulling all of those different ideas and perspectives together, we wanted to talk about it and find a way to make everybody more aware about what has historically happened and what's happening today.
Yeah, a great point. As you said, some people who had to face legal issues because of possession, because at that time, that's the way the laws were written. And still, like you said, a lame duck sitting either in jail or still waiting to be vindicated, if you will. But let's go back to a couple of things that I've seen happen in the last few years. And I've heard this from, you know, a lot of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, from the medical community. I mean, people, I always think that doctors are going to stick to prescribing aspirin and, you know, a warm blanket and a lot of fluids, because that's what I heard growing up. But many, many people in the medical community, from researchers to MDs, are on board with this. So the point I'm getting at is many believe that they're, you know, because of the medical benefits to cannabis, that was also an important factor in changing legislation in this country. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And when we think back 100 years, maybe even a little bit less, cannabis was widely available for a lot of different ailments. And because of that, you know, there if you look at older populations, there has been a historical usage of cannabis and other plant-based medicines as well for common day aches and pains, as well as larger illnesses. And my own entrance into the cannabis industry was driven by the fact that in 2013, my grandfather was suffering from stage 4 lung cancer. And that's why I started looking at cannabis, why my mother is the one who was curious about it, because we were just looking for something that could provide him some relief as he was going through chemotherapy. And so the medicinal side of it has really been the leading element when you think about legislation and why there are such strong advocates, because there are real stories out there about how it has benefited people in such a wide range that modern day medications haven't been able to have that same impact. And so it's really just kind of taking it back to where it started before all of these prohibition elements started, which really came from racism. You know, it was a way, it was society control, as opposed to saying, okay, we have this, we're trying to make everybody safe. It really wasn't rooted in that. And that, those are some elements that we get into in the book so people can understand how we got here. And then how we actually create a more equitable path forward.
Yeah, good point. I want to just take a quick pause and remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. My guest this week is author Tahira Rahmatullah. Her new book is Waiting to Inhale, and we're talking about the progression of cannabis legalization, the impact it's had on various social and economic groups here in this country. And Tahira, very interesting because you're right. I know friends too, cancer in various stages. The only relief, not a cure, but the only relief to the suffering has been through cannabis. But you also, just to go into a little bit more detail with the book, and you hit upon that a little earlier on, is the fact that there's been an imbalance, if you will, for lack of a better term, in the cannabis industry. It's now a widely growing industry. Many people are profiting successfully and hugely financially from this. And others are kind of left by the side of the road, can't get access to it for whatever reason. And again, you point out in the book that a lot of that goes back it becomes a racial issue, right?
Absolutely. And when we think about how cannabis prohibition came to be, it started really after the Mexican Revolution. And this was about how do you control certain populations. So Mexicans were affiliated closely with cannabis and bring it into the U.S. Black Americans were tied to heroin, Asians with opium. You know, it was just, there were stereotypes that were starting to form. And as a way to really focus on those communities in a negative way, the war on drugs developed over time. And then the quote-unquote war on drugs didn't formally develop until the 1970s under the Nixon administration. But the suppression of these different minority groups had been happening for decades. It was just formalized in a way in, you know, a nice pretty bow to present it to the public. To make it seem like, you know, this is safe for all Americans. I mean, I'm a child of the 1980s, you know, Nancy Reagan, Just Say No. But then when I actually got to learn how did all of this come to be, you realize it was really based on control and racism around these different populations. And now when we look at today, who are the leaders of the cannabis industry, who the majority of the businesses, who are they owned by? It's not people who have been longstanding advocates or people who, you know, had been operating in the legacy industry. It's predominantly white men from other industries who saw the opportunity and had the means to be able to get engaged, while less than 2% of businesses in the industry are owned by Black and brown people, and, you know, less than, call it 20%, are businesses that are led by women. And so there's this massive inequity that has developed, just unfortunately, like other industries. But we had hoped that cannabis would be different considering why it came to be in the first place.
You hit on something that resonated with me. Again, growing up, not so much from parents. Believe it or not, my parents were somewhat naive to this. Not the idea of, you know, you certainly don't want your children on drugs, but it was that general theme. But others would say, go ahead. You know, you smoke that first marijuana cigarette and it's going to lead to heroin and all kinds of horrible things. And it's going to ruin your life, if not kill you. What I'm getting at is there people put the fear of God into some, and some took it to heart, myself being one. Others did not. And I'm sure, again, along the lines of socioeconomic groups, that message was also, that message was out there. But the fact of the matter is that at the same time, when we said, well, where's this all coming from? Well, it's you know, it's inner city gangs, it's minorities, and they're the ones who are promoting it, and you know, they're making all this, they're making all this cash. It's illegal, and then they're, you know, doing other things with it, and then getting involved into other forms of crime. So what I'm getting at, the picture painted for me as a teenager was one of horror, and you know, and then after reading your book, it's like, well, you know, that might have been true to some extent, but not entirely, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say the element around cannabis being a gateway drug. What we say is that, yes, cannabis is a gateway drug, but not necessarily a gateway to harder drug use, as most people would say, but actually it's a gateway into the criminal justice system for society's most marginalized populations. That's what it's the gateway to. And both in the U.S. and Canada, there is over-policing in certain community groups, you know, certain housing developments. It has been used as an excuse to be able to focus on those communities. We have some stories in the book about real people who have been in prison for cannabis crimes, one of them being a man named Michael Thompson, who had was given 42 to 60 years in prison for selling a very small amount of cannabis to somebody who turned out to be an informant. But that prison sentence was further enhanced because police found guns in his home, which had absolutely nothing to do with the transaction itself. But it's used as a tool to then find other things to put people away, to abuse those communities, to disrupt those communities, to point to say, like, look, this is the bad stuff that's happening, when it's not. You know, this, it's a way to wage a war against people and control communities as opposed to actually help the communities that we think, you know, cannabis usage is the same from black and brown people to white people. But if you look at who's actually in prison and who's been, you know, jailed for these crimes, it's predominantly black and brown people.
Now with that said, here's the conflict that I have. You know, it took a long time, but, you know, Congress and state lawmakers basically passed, as I said, in many, if not all, parts of the country today, the legalization of you know, especially for medical uses. So these same people who are now saying, yeah, it's fine. I mean, you know, there's certain guidelines we want you to follow, but this is, by and large, we're on board with this. But yet they've not addressed, it sounds like, at least through your book, that the inconsistencies and the injustice that was caused prior to lawmakers making any moves. Should they have, in tandem with promoting or legalizing cannabis, should they have also eased up on some of the laws, looked at past cases and said, you can't, you know, this is ridiculous. Someone's going to serve 30, 40, 50 years for what was back then considered a misdemeanor. What I'm getting at is, have lawmakers dropped the ball here?
Absolutely. And some have tried on a state-by-state basis to be able to improve what's happening and improve upon as each state regulates to impose certain guidelines and ways that the cannabis industry within that state can give back to the communities who are most harmed by the war on drugs. It's certainly not perfect, and every rollout has shown its own complications. So right now, as we're watching New York State, for example, they have written in social equity policies and dispensary licenses, the way that the ordering of giving out those licenses starts with those who have been previously impacted by the war on drugs. Again, not a perfect system, but it put them at the top of the line to be able to participate within the industry. Now, it comes with its own challenges because others have been waiting for the licensing. So again, not a perfect system. The challenge continues to be that at the federal level, we are illegal on cannabis. It's still a Schedule I narcotic, you know, equivalent to heroin in the eyes of that schedule. So we're on a state-by-state basis when it comes to legality on both the medical and adult use side. And so it's up to the states to create those policies and enforce those policies. And they've been pretty wide-ranging. The enforcement has been pretty wide-ranging. We're still early, but our opinion is very much that those types of services, you know, policies, they need to be part of the legislation from day one. They can't be introduced later. It just never works. Mm-hmm. And for lack of better words, reparations need to be considered in all elements when it comes to cannabis, but they have to come over time as well, and they have to be well thought out. I mean, think of the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have been impacted by the war on drugs, specifically around cannabis. There are multiple ways where we have to consider how to right those wrongs, and it happens, you know, all across the country. Unfortunately, because of the federal illegality, there is not one fell swoop effort that can take place to be able to right those wrongs. So we really rely on the state-by-state basis, and then we rely on other organizations. So a great example, and one that I'm very passionate about, is the Last Prisoner Project, which is an organization that is focused on getting those who are impacted by the war on drugs out of prison and freeing them, because they've been unjustly imprisoned for cannabis.
Yeah, good point. Going back to another point that you made, largely these cannabis organizations that are, you know, I've seen chains literally sprouting up right here in central Massachusetts and other parts of the state, as well as New England in general. I don't know about other parts of the country. But, you know, like other industries, once there has been a monopoly created, they control not only the industry itself, but the lawmakers. In the back of your mind, is this another concern that, you know, this whole industry, for the most part, at least to the present time, is in the control of a certain few powerful people who have now made an inroad in the cannabis industry, and they can basically call the shots, and because of the amount of money that they're raking in, and let's make no mistake about it, you know, money is certainly going to have a role in how legislation goes. So are you concerned that those few or any monopoly will have unprecedented power and influence on lawmakers to address issues that are only positive to them, are only going to benefit them? Is that a concern that people should have?
It is a concern, and we've already seen it happen to some degree where there are larger operators that have been able to start early in the space, and you know, they're innovative and entrepreneurial in their own right, but have had the resources. And that's what it really comes down to. Who has the resources to spend the money or take the risk, you know, the career risk, to be without an income for a period of time, you know, work with lobbyists in order to influence these different policies. You know, that is a select group of people. And that is not necessarily in the best interest of the population, the larger population, but particularly those who have been impacted. So it takes champions within those groups to actually be able to push the change. It's not happening by the prisoners themselves or people who have been formerly incarcerated. You know, what resources do they have to go and push those agendas and make sure that they're included? So at the government level, at the business level, it's incredibly important that people are advocates for social equity. Otherwise, it's not going to get done.
Yeah. Again, good point. You know, those in the power, those who have the power, those who have the financial means, will certainly always be heard. You know, money talks, and you know, yeah, you know the saying goes. Going back, I remember reading about prohibition. You know, alcohol was basically banned. You know, this was the thing that was going to bring down society. And as I said, going back to the cannabis issue, you know, growing up as a teenager, that's the kind of talk that I heard, not from all circles, but, you know, people who were perhaps a little bit more in a conservative frame of mind, a lot of parents growing up always warning their kids. We've come a long way with all of this, but again, I sometimes take a step back and I say, okay, let me digest what's going on here. And I don't know, maybe it's because of the generation that I grew up in. I don't think younger people today would feel quite the same way, but I just want to get your sense on this. I too have some apprehension. So is that weird? I mean, should I be on board? You know, I know you've seen it from wider perspective than I certainly have. You researched this much more closely than I have. You've seen it from all angles. But I sometimes say, okay, I can see it, as you talked about, your grandfather. I have family and friends who need it for just to ease the pain of terminal cancer or something to that effect. But I still sometimes take a step back and say, well, okay, I'm kind of on board with this, but are we going, are we opening a can of worms here? Is in the long run this only going to open the door for more promiscuity? Is this going to open the door for more crime? Is this going to open the door for more addictive behaviors? You know, should that fear be running through me at times the way it does?
You know, I share similar concerns, and that's why I think that the regulation is actually more beneficial to society than harmful. We've seen pilots in other countries. Portugal is a good example of decriminalizing, or the legalization of these substances has actually allowed for a reduction in usage. There's almost the element of, if it's the less available that it is, the more people want it and the more potentially people can abuse it. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, cannabis is 150% safe. I think too much of anything, sugar, coffee, you name it, I think all of it can be detrimental to your health. And so there's always the need for moderation, but the legalization allows us to make it safely available, not grown in basements and, you know, sprayed with fentanyl or what have you, you know, all the things that are out there. It will be tested. Mm-hmm. You will know what's in it. And that, I think, is really important from just the purely the safety lens itself. You know, the opioid epidemic, everything that's happened there, we're continuing to hear about the growth and the challenge in managing that. And so I think that, you know, there's an element of being able to give people choices in a safe way that will allow them to make better decisions. I mean, and we're not stopping here. That's the reality. Right now there's cannabis. The next wave of movement has been with psychedelics. And again, they're available in the illicit market, but when you introduce them into the legal market, it allows people to use them in a safe way with better information. It allows us as a country, as a government, as the world, to be able to actually test, do clinical trials, have a better understanding. Right now we're less so than we were even 5 years ago, but you're operating in the dark. And this stuff has been out there for thousands and thousands of years. We should know more about it. But the only way we can do that is if we introduce it in a way that we can safely test it.
Yeah, a very good point. Again, there's a lot to look at here. You know, it's not just a matter of, hey, let the floodgates open. The other thing, and I'm glad that you kind of felt the same way, that there's always a certain amount of apprehension because, you know, recently it's been nightly we hear, whether it's overseas or right here in our own country, you know, the only people that have access to this, the people that are really putting this stuff out on the streets, are the cartels, and they don't care about human life. And, you know, there's a wave of fear that's always prevalent. And as you said, the main thing is for people to just to get all the information they can and realize that with regulation, you know, there is a safe alternative to how to dispense cannabis and make it safe for people who genuinely need it, not just somebody who wants to, you know, smoke pot all day and stay high. As we start to wind down, was there something in preparation for the book and research for the book? Was there anything, because you sound very well versed, and I know you are in this topic, but was there something that really caught you by surprise and said, I had no idea, and you know, this is great, let's put this in the book? Was there any one facet to this industry or to the topic at hand that really you know, caught you by surprise?
I think that the biggest element that caught me by surprise, as we talked to different people who have been impacted by the war on drugs, are the incredibly harsh penalties you hear about them, but it's a broad kind of nameless, faceless conversation that we're having. So when you actually have real people and you hear that they're getting life sentences, 20 years, 40 years for the equivalent of a joint, that really hit me. Like, how have we allowed that to happen? How do we think that that is fair and just in the world that we live in? How have we gone so far as to let that be the standard to do that to our own communities? And that really struck me. And that's why when Akwasi and I, you know, you go through a lot of different iterations of a book. And what we really turned to was we really wanted to share those stories, use this as a way to share the stories of real people. So people can, in the world can understand who these people are. You know, they're moms, they're dads, they're somebody's child.
Yeah.
They're not just thugs. They're not. Most of them are just normal people.
Yeah.
And this has been, I think, what we want more of is outrage so people understand what we need to do to fix this.
Yeah. That was the, and I'm glad you said that. That's why I had asked the question, because after finishing the book, and my own sense was, I said, this caught my attention more than anything else that was in the book, is that fact that, like you said, a joint and you're doing 20, 30, 40 years, man, there are people who get, there's people with, you know, violent behaviors, career criminals who get less time, who get, you know, more liberal terms. Something definitely has to be done about that. So I'm so glad, you know, you put it between the pages of the book in an intelligent fashion, just not something discussed on a street corner, although I'm sure it gets discussed on street corners as well. But, it's a book that will help bring this to the forefront, but doing so in an intelligent manner. Read it, get a sense of what's really happening, and as I always say, then people can make their own their own determinations from there. Real quickly before we wrap up this evening, let me ask you, if people want to get more information about the work that you're doing, not only with the book itself but ongoing in regards to this, is there a way of reaching out to you directly?
Yeah, on social media, you can find me on Instagram or Twitter at Tahira Rehm. That's TAHIRAREHM. And then also LinkedIn, very active there. So I would love to hear from people.
There you go. There's the invitation. Tahira's put it out there. So it's up to listeners. Again, the book is Waiting to Inhale. And as I said, a real down-to-earth and intelligent approach to the industry, where it's been, where it is today, and hopefully, you know, where it's going. And the people that have fallen between the cracks in the process, which is really the most poignant part of the whole book. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. Again, I want to thank my guests this week, author Tahira Rehmatulla. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.